This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with John Berry, the author of Rising Tide and a deposed member of a levee board near New Orleans. Governor Bobby Jindal saw to it that John Berry was sent on his way after Berry led the fight for a lawsuit against the oil and gas industry. We'll talk with him about what's happened since, including last week's cover story in the New York Times Magazine regarding John Berry and his work, and also John Lewis, the fabled civil rights leader, congressman. He's coming to Louisiana State University in a few days and has a new book, and we'll talk with him and his co-author. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Our guest is John Berry, one of the most remarkable writers in this world, and he has become an activist in the last year. A man synonymous with Louisiana through his writing, and in particular the book Rising Tide. He was the focus of a cover story of the New York Times Magazine last week on October 5th. The caption on the cover reads, "Every hour an acre of Louisiana sinks into the sea. Who is to blame?" And then one day later, as in last Monday, Judge Janice Clark here in Baton Rouge ruled that Act 544 of 2014, filed as Senate Bill 469, does not apply to the lawsuit filed by the SLFPAE group in New Orleans, the levee board. Senate Bill 469 was specifically crafted to kill the lawsuit retroactively. So, John Berry, obviously you're crowing about the events of the last week. How significant is this ruling from Judge Clark?
A couple things. First, I'm not crowing. I'm not a crower. I'm obviously pleased by it. Second, you know, the funny thing is I don't consider myself an activist. I'm sure other people do, but, you know, I am a writer. I've always been a writer. I consider myself a writer, but I know I certainly have been active. In terms of your question, I think it's, in a legal sense, I'm not sure how important it is. The main, this ruling was in a suit actually against the Attorney General for approving the contract the Flood Authority had with the lawyers. The suit was brought by Louisiana Oil and Gas Association. The main lawsuit is in federal court. So it doesn't directly impact the federal court, but it's a very, very good harbinger. I can tell you that everybody associated with the case, at least on our side, was pretty optimistic about the ruling because the law is so poorly worded. It prohibits, quote, local government entities, unquote. And the Flood Authority is not, according to the state constitution, a local government entity. And for that reason, we were very optimistic. So I think it's a great harbinger for the federal court decision. I'm not sure if it has, you know, legally impacts the federal court. On the other hand, why would a federal judge overrule a state judge on a state law?
In the story last week in the New York Times, it goes into great depth about Senate Bill 469 and the machinations that were involved in killing the bill. And the governor pulled out all his troops on this one, and he had an army of lobbyists to help him. I think 44 different lobbyists were at the Capitol.
I think it was 70, actually.
70. But some of them were on your side, right?
No, 70 for the oil and gas industry. We had about 10.
All right, so that's a 7-to-1 disadvantage. And you note that some people you thought were in your camp, they defected.
Well, we knew there was going to be a lot of pressure. I know that shortly, there were several times during the session where we felt if we could only vote now, we would win. But we also knew the full weight of the governor's office. Several legislators said to us that the governor had told them his number one priority in the entire session was killing the lawsuit. So you have the weight of the governor's office, all the power that Governor of Louisiana has, and he's one of the most powerful governors in the country. You know, he picks the secretary, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate, and has control over committee chairs and all sorts of things, in addition to budgetary control. So you have his power, and then you have the most powerful political force in the state, the oil and gas industry. You got them on one side. We knew that we were going to lose some of the people who gave us commitments, and the question was, will we lose so many that we would lose the vote? And there were, as you know, and your listeners probably recall, well over a dozen, depending on how you count, as many as 19 bills that were filed that one way or another would have killed the lawsuit. And all but one of them we did succeed in killing.
Well, why is this bill, or was it, so important to Governor Jindal in your estimation?
You know, it doesn't make sense to me. I always thought from when we first conceived of the lawsuit that it would be in his own best interest politically and for the state if he embraced the lawsuit, or more accurately maybe let it go forward and kept his distance from it, because it was far enough removed from him that he could tell folks he had nothing to do with it, and yet if it was successful, it solved a major problem for the state, and he could get credit for it. So I've always been puzzled. You know, there are only two, this is speculation, only two reasons I could think of. Number one is campaign contributions from the oil and gas industry, and number two is, you know, maybe he just doesn't like the idea of somebody disagreeing with him. He does have a history of being pretty hard on anybody who disagrees with him.
You state in the New York Times piece that 36% of the damage done to the coast through the years has been acknowledged to have been done by the oil and gas industry, acknowledged by the industry itself. Is that accurate?
Well, that comes from a study overseen by the U.S. Geological Survey that was partly paid for by the Gas Institute, and that was had industry scientists from Exxon and I think Chevron and other major oil companies participating in the study, and those scientists signed off on the conclusions. Does LOGA, Louisiana Oil and Gas, acknowledge 36%? I doubt it. You know, they still blame the Nutria. Not that Nutria aren't part of the problem, but they not that kind of level of a problem. You know, but the Trade Association for the Major Oil Companies, which is Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas, they did their own study around 1990, and they're not for the whole state, but for part of the state. That study concluded, quote, the overwhelming cause, unquote, overwhelming cause was their own operations in the Barataria and Terrebonne basins. So that was very much industry, and they didn't put a number on it, but overwhelming cause is a lot more than 36% in that part of the state.
Is the best way to get the oil industry to negotiate to perhaps have a lawsuit that's out there that might prompt some sort of discussion?
That's the plan. As you've heard me say in the past on your show, maybe the clincher in making us go forward was in December 2012, 8 months before we filed the lawsuit, the president of the Flood Authority and I and our in-house counsel sat down with Garrett Graves, who's now running for Congress, and told him what we were planning. And I said to him at the time, why don't we go to Chris John, head of the Trade Association for the Majors, and ask and tell him what we're thinking about and try to work out a statewide deal. And Garrett said, I already tried that. They're not there yet. And that really, I think, was a compelling argument to go forward for the board. If he tried, they said, no, they're not there yet. How do you get them to the table? You get their attention. Mm-hmm. You just tell them we're serious. And from day one, when we filed the lawsuit, we said we were looking to have them around the table and work out a mutually agreeable settlement. So we have never been anything other than that. We want a settlement. Mm-hmm. We would love the state to be involved, love for the state to be involved, and work out a deal for the entire state.
Now, Buddy Caldwell, the Attorney General, indicated that there had been some movement toward negotiation while the lawsuit was still active. Do you think he's right?
Well, I know there was, and he said that on your show. I remember it very well. And there certainly was movement. I think there will be movement again since we seem to be doing pretty well in court right now. And maybe even more important than the court decision was the fact that Paul Kemp, one of the board members, was renominated. You know, there's a complex nominating process. The governor had tried to get control of the board so that the board would withdraw the lawsuit, but right now it looks like that a pro-lawsuit majority will remain in the board for, you know, pretty close to a year at least, maybe more.
Well, and Jindal's term expires.
That's exactly
right. In a year and a few months. But were you surprised that Kemp survived?
I wasn't, actually. I think a lot of people associated with the suit, including the attorneys, were surprised and didn't expect it. But I think that the nominating committee, you know, they weren't thrilled, a lot of members of that committee, with some of the things that had happened and some of the people who had gone on, I don't want to start calling names, but I think they felt that they had a responsibility, that Paul Kemp was extremely well qualified, and they were not going to yield simply to political pressure to get rid of him when his qualifications were so extraordinarily great.
Well, last week, the story in the New York Times that has generated a great deal of attention here and elsewhere started this way, saying in Louisiana, the most common way to visualize the state's existential crisis is through the metaphor of football fields. The formulation, repeated in nearly every local newspaper article about the subject, goes like this: every hour, Louisiana loses about a football field's worth of land. Each day, the state loses nearly the accumulated acreage of every football stadium in the NFL. Were this rate of land loss applied to New York, Central Park would disappear in a month, Manhattan would vanish in a year and a half, and the last of Brooklyn would dissolve in 4 years. New Yorkers would notice this kind of land loss. The world would notice this kind of land loss. But the hemorrhaging of Louisiana's coastal wetlands has gone largely unremarked upon beyond state borders. This is surprising because the wetlands, apart from their unique ecological significance and astounding beauty, buffer the impact of hurricanes that threaten not just New Orleans, but also the Port of South Louisiana, the nation's largest. Just under 10% of the country's oil reserves, a quarter of its natural gas supply, a fifth of its oil refinery capacity, and the gateway to its internal waterway system. The attenuation of Louisiana, like any environmental disaster carried beyond a certain point, is a national security threat. You couldn't have written the script any better, and you write pretty well, John Barry.
Nathaniel Rich is a pretty good writer, too.
He did a nice job, but he made the case pretty well that this is something that warrants immediate attention.
I'm with him, and I think everybody in the state agrees with him.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. We shall return with John Barry, the author of The Rising Tide, who's lived in the French Quarter off and on since 1972. We'll be back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest for a bit longer is John Barry, the author of many celebrated books, and perhaps most notably in this part, Rising Tide, the Great Louisiana Flood of 1927. And here we are in 2014, and our state is in peril because of erosion of the coast. And the New York Times, and the story that John and I have cited in our discussion in the first segment, in a story written by Nathaniel Rich, states that the oil and gas industry has extracted $470 billion, with a B, in natural resources from the state in the last two decades, with the tacit blessing of the federal and state government, and without significant opposition from environmental groups. Oil and gas is, after all, Louisiana's leading industry, supplying about $1 billion a year in annual tax revenue. You can understand the clout that the industry has and the affinity that some have for it. After all, it does supply a lot of jobs and has done some good things in this state. So what's the next step, John Barry?
Well, first, I want to make sure everybody understands no one associated with the lawsuit is against the industry. We have tried to make that clear from day one. I worked for the industry myself when I was a kid, like a lot of your listeners. And, you know, that's one of the reasons when we started, I said, no, I'm not an activist. I don't want to be seen. I probably am an environmentalist, but I'm not an environmental activist. The reality is, for the foreseeable future, we're going to be using fossil fuels. We are not against the industry. All we want is for the industry to honor its permits and obey the law, something which they did not do. If they did honor their permits and they did obey the law, then they will win the lawsuit. And I think they recognize their failings, and that's why they work so hard to prevent this lawsuit from ever going to court. So I did want to make that clear. We're not against the industry. We just want them to keep their word and obey the law. So as far as your actual question, where do we go from here? I think it's largely out of the political sphere, although it may not ever be entirely out of the political sphere, and it's pretty much moved to court now. There's a federal court ruling, a hearing, I should say, oral arguments on some motions on November 12th. The attorneys for the flood authority have, put forward a motion for summary judgment that Act 544 does not apply, or if it does apply, it's unconstitutional, so that's not a defense available to the defendants. And if the federal judge rules the same way the state rules, then everything's in play. The defendants have also put forward some motions which actually get very deep into the substance of the legal arguments in the case and go well beyond the law the legislature passed in this past session. So,
a question from Leonard. He says, Jim, the subtext is people outside of Louisiana are more aware of the erosion than the people of Louisiana. Why, and how can that be changed to create political will?
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with that. I think that the people around the country are becoming aware, and I think that story last Sunday was a huge help, that you read pretty much the opening paragraph. I don't think people realized it. You're talking about losing all of Manhattan in a year and a half. That's just the rate of land loss. That's not you're talking about losing the state of Delaware over a period of 70 years. So double the state of Rhode Island. So I don't think people around the country really have understood that. I think in Louisiana, certainly everybody around the coast knows it. And one of the reasons we had a chance for success in the legislature is that a lot of conservatives, they hunt and fish. They go out there. They know the land has disappeared. they know where they used to stand. They're not. They are now traveling over those areas in boats, and they can see the damage from the canals. So they recognize the pretty solid grounds that the lawsuit rests upon, and the problem.
You have a worthy adversary in State Senator Robert Adley, and he, on this show and others, has claimed that the oil and gas industry complied with the law, and that there's no compelling reason to sue an industry that retroactively. But your argument is that they did not do what they signed up to do.
If he's right, they win. It's as simple as that. So in that case, why go through all these machinations to keep the lawsuit from going to court?
Mm-hmm.
If he's right, they win, period.
Right. Now, you had hopes at one time that Senator Mary Landrieu would be on your side. It appears she's gone the other direction on this one.
Well, when the lawsuit was first filed, she said, fight for the coast everywhere, including in the courts, which was almost an endorsement. She has backed away from that. To my knowledge, she hasn't attacked the lawsuit. She has said that the solution for the coast is not in the courts. She has legislation in the Congress to expand. She was the one responsible largely for passing the law which will give Louisiana up to a couple $100 million a year beginning in 2017, and she wants to expand that law so that Louisiana would get more money, and I support that law. She thinks that's the solution. I don't think they're mutually exclusive, and in fact, I think there may be a better chance in court of getting money soon than there is passing legislation in Congress.
Is chair of the Senate Energy Committee and a native New Orleanian, Mary Landrieu, an 18-year U.S. senator, her opinion would seem to count a lot, maybe a lot more than Governor Jindal on this.
If she's reelected, her opinion counts a heck of a lot.
Well, it counts a lot right now, but it may not count a whole lot in a few months. But she, I suspect, for political purposes, has not talked a whole lot about this. She doesn't think that it has a cachet as far as gaining votes. I think she might be mistaken about that, John.
Well, our polls certainly indicate that, we had like 74% to 21% believed that the legislature should not intervene in the lawsuit, that the courts and evidence should decide what happens. I think there is a lot of support out there for our position. And as I said, I'm not against the industry. The industry has tried to portray me as being against them, but that is not accurate. They try to scare people. The other thing is, I believe you had on as a guest, Tim Ryan, the former chancellor of UNO, who did a study of the jobs that would be created if we actually funded the master plan, if we actually had the money to do it. And the numbers were astronomical, I think, as I recall, depending on the level of funding, it ranged from 108,000 jobs to 212,000 jobs. And these were good jobs, certainly as good a job as any that the industry provides. So on the one hand, I don't believe we'll lose any jobs if the lawsuit proceeds. And yet, if you get money to fund coastal restoration, you will create jobs, very good jobs. So I think it's really a pro-business position, not to mention the fact that the coastal restoration is going to protect the infrastructure of the oil and gas industry. So it's in their own self-interest.
We'll be joining Congressman John Lewis in just a few moments, but as we round out the discussion with John Barry, the people most vocal on this issue are those not in public life as office holders. You've got you and Russell Honoré and James Carville. The only person in public life who has really pounded the table for years is Foster Campbell, and the oil and gas industry is coming after him with a vengeance in his race for the PSC this year. Lawmakers think it's a tough situation to be against the biggest, be perceived as being against the biggest industry in the state. Do you understand that?
Well, I certainly understand someone being intimidated by the idea that you've got an opponent who will invest, an unlimited amount of money in funding a race, against you. So that can be intimidating. As I said, two, three times already, this is not an anti-industry lawsuit. This is an obey-the-law lawsuit. If they didn't break the law, if they didn't violate their permits, they win the lawsuit. I think it's a very conservative position, and I think it's a pro-business position. I don't think the industry should be above the law any more than anyone else in the United States should be above the law. And I don't think the industry should have advantages that no other business in Louisiana has. So I know that politicians tend to be cautious. I do think, and indeed, you mentioned James Carville earlier, I know he's told me that he thinks somebody can run for office on this when the idea of holding the industry accountable statewide and win. And that this lawsuit has permanently changed the conversation in Louisiana. I hope that's the least that it's done, and I, more importantly, I hope that eventually it will bring the industry to the table and that we will get a statewide deal and that we will have then some money to give us a chance to save the coast and protect people living in the southern part of the state.
Well, John Berry, it's always good to visit with you. Coach Berry, and I was astounded.
That's the first time I've been on, you didn't mention it. and we're in the middle of football season, but that's okay.
Well, there's only one photo on your wall in your office, is that right?
No, that's not. There's only one. The page, the front page of the day after the game, we're talking about the 1973 Tulane victory over LSU. I was on the coaching staff of the Tulane team.
14-0.
Right. Jim often, usually kids me about that. But I've laminated that page, and that's on my office wall.
And the crowd was 86,000?
958, as I remember.
December
1. The biggest crowd ever to see a game in the South, football, pro, college or pro.
At that time, yes. December 1, 1973, and as we move to Congressman Lewis, how about Mississippi State and Ole Miss? My goodness.
That is something. I am astounded and pleased that programs like that can build to that level of success.
Well, John Berry, we thank you, and I also learned that John continues to pump iron with the best of them. And
despite all the injuries,
So you got real muscle, and the lawmakers who went the other way, some of them have muscle that comes with being affiliated with the largest industry in the state. So perhaps that's an even match. I'm not sure, but it's an interesting
one. We'll find out.
Thank you.
Right now we're doing pretty good, I think.
All right. Well, take care.
Thank you.
John,
bye.
Bye-bye. And we're joined now by Congressman John Lewis, who will be coming to Baton Rouge in a few days. He's an American icon, one of the key figures of the civil rights movement. His commitment to justice and nonviolence has taken him from an Alabama sharecropper's farm to the halls of Congress, from a segregated schoolroom to the 1963 March on Washington, and from receiving beatings from state troopers to receiving the Medal of Freedom from the first African-American president. He's written about his life and times in a book entitled March, and his author, co-author, Andrew Iden, is also with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Well, Congressman Lewis, you've been around for a while, and you've known just about every major person involved in the civil rights movement. You've seen it evolve. Where do we stand now after all these years?
Well, I have been around for a while, but I first must tell you that I'm delighted and very pleased to be with you. I look forward to being at LSU within the next a few days, to be exact. I believe it's October the 21st. I said from time to time that in America during the past few years, we have witnessed what I like to call a nonviolent revolution, a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas. In our country, and especially the region that I grew up in, is a much better region. When people tell me nothing has changed, I feel like saying, come and walk in my shoes, and I will show you change. We are on our way to creating one community, one nation. In the real sense, we are one people, and we are one family. We are the American family. The signs that I saw when I was growing up that said white waiting, colored waiting, white men, white women, colored women, those signs are gone, and they will not return. The only places our children will see those signs will be in a book, in a museum, or on a video. And I think there's a greater sense of hope today, especially in the American South, than any other part of the country. So I'm very hopeful and very optimistic about the future.
Why is there hope in the South that perhaps exceeds hope anywhere else?
Well, here in the South, we made progress. We had tried over and over again to confront our problems, confront our issues head on, and not sweep them under the rug or in some dark corner. And the people, as I travel around the South, they give me a lot of hope to see young people, and people not so young, black and white and Latinos and others, trying to work together to create what Dr. King called the beloved community.
297-5633. We'll hear from author Andrew Iden in a moment as well, who has collaborated with Congressman Lewis in a book called March. It's a vivid firsthand account of John Lewis's lifelong struggle for civil and human rights. You were 23 when Martin Luther King and several thousand of his closest friends had the March on Washington. Did you know at the time that that would be as vivid a day as it has turned out to be?
At the time that we were planning the March on Washington and making preparation to make it to Washington on August 28, 1963, I don't think we had any idea that that day would be such a powerful day in American history. But as Dr. King and others of us spoke and assembled there, you felt the spirit that this would be a day and a time that people would never forget. I remember so well when I was introduced to speak. I spoke number 6, Dr. King spoke number 10, and after the march was all over, President Kennedy invited us back down to the White House. And he kept saying to each one of us, you've done a good job. You did a good job. You did a good job.
We shall return with Congressman John Lewis and Andrew Iden in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Congressman John Lewis is with us, along with his co-author Andrew Iden, and we are here to talk about his life, Congressman Lewis's, and his appearance at Louisiana State University coming the 21st. He will be here for a book signing hosted by University College, and he is an icon of the civil rights movement. Now 74 years old, he was a young man when the world was changing. You were 28 when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I'm sure you remember that day quite vividly as well, Congressman Lewis.
Yes, I do remember the day very well. I was in Indianapolis, Indiana, with Bobby Kennedy during his campaign. We heard that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. It was a sad time. It was a very difficult time. Like so many other Americans, I cried. Dr. King was my friend. He was my hero. He was like a big brother. I first heard of him in 1955 when I was 15 years old. 3 years later, in 1958, I met Dr. King for the first time. His leadership and his words changed my life forever.
And 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy was killed.
Robert Kennedy was someone that I admired and I love. I was in his hotel room at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. I've been campaigning for him since he first announced that he would seek the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And I spoke to him about 15 minutes before he went down to make his victory statement. And it was very sad. I had said after Dr. King was assassinated, I said, well, we still have Bobby. And then 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy was gone.
297-5633. We will go to the phone lines in a moment. Andrew Iden, who is the author of March, the book that will be discussed and will be available for public consumption when Congressman Lewis comes this way in a few days. Andrew, it must have been quite a treat for you to work with this gentleman.
Oh, absolutely. I've worked with Congressman Lewis for 8 years now. I started out in his congressional office answering the mail. And, I became his press secretary on his 2008 campaign, and that's when we had the idea to create this graphic novel, March, together. And it was inspired by a comic book that was used during the Civil Rights Movement to inspire many of the young people in the South and elsewhere to take up nonviolence. And that's what's so special about Congressman Lewis, is that he's had a lifelong commitment to use nonviolence not simply as a tactic, but as a way of life. And I think that's been a big reason as to why he's been so successful in his pursuit of social justice, but also what makes him such a good and decent human being. And that's why I think it's so important that we have created this graphic novel that's been on the New York Times bestseller list now for 40 weeks, because this generation, my generation, those younger than me, they need to know. They need to know that this is a human being they can emulate, who's a real hero, who lived a life that so many of us should try to emulate, and that he's actually affected change in such a substantive, broad, far-reaching way. We, as young people, often underestimate our power. And John Lewis shows us through his story, through his life, through his actions, that power can truly change the world.
Well, John Lewis has represented Georgia's 5th Congressional District since 1987. He's the dean of the Georgia Congressional Delegation. His district includes the northern three-quarters of Atlanta, and John Lewis is the only living Big Six leader of the American Civil Rights Movement, having been the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and playing a key role in the struggle to end legalized racial discrimination and segregation. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Congressman Lewis and Andrew Iden. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Congressman. Is there anything that Congress can do to counter voter suppression efforts in states with Republican governors and Republican majority legislatures?
When the Congress reconvenes, when we have a new Congress, I think we should fix what the Supreme Court did to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. There is a deliberate, systematic effort on the part of many of the governors and state legislatures to take us back to another period. And it's not just in the American South, but in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Arizona, or Wisconsin. And in recent days, we've had the United States Supreme Court to set what these states have been trying to do. It's not right. It's not fair. It's not just. So I think the Supreme Court would see that maybe, just maybe, they made a mistake by putting a dagger in the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Question from a listener about the U.S. Senate race in Georgia. You have a hot one, as we do in Louisiana. How's it looking in Georgia?
Well, I think the race in Georgia is looking interesting. I think the daughter of Senator Sam Nunn, Michelle Nunn, has a real opportunity of winning. It's all a matter of turnout. People turn out in large number, she would prevail.
A question from a listener, John in Covington. He wants to know if Congressman Lewis draws any parallels between the civil rights movement of the 1960s and ecological rights activism of today.
Oh, there is much the same as one movement of the same. When people see something that is not right, not fair, not just, they have to speak up, they have to speak out, they have to do something about it. And we encourage people to use the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. We have to learn to live together on this little piece of real estate that we call the earth and leave it a little cleaner, a little greener, and a little more peaceful for all humankind.
Another listener, Hal, asks, how well did you know H. Rapp Brown, who grew up not so far from our studio in Baton Rouge, Louisiana?
I met Rapp over the years, but I never really got to know him. He was considerably younger, and he came within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the time that I was leaving.
And he was one who ultimately was jailed because of a violent act.
Well, I would say that some individuals never accepted the way of nonviolence, the way of peace, the way of love, as a way of life, as a way of living. During those early days, many of the students, young people from Louisiana, from Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, all over the South, became committed to the way of nonviolence. And we believe that we don't have a right to destroy the dignity and the worth of any human beings, that we all are precious. And we may disagree with individuals, but we have to be kind, be loving to our fellow human beings.
The book is March from Andrew Iden. It's a graphic novel about the life of John Lewis, the congressman and a fabled member of the civil rights movement, who will be at LSU on the 21st of this month. David at LSU, good morning.
Good morning. Sir, would you please tell us a program that you have developed that's very effective in proving the work to reach young African-American mothers at home to help them learn how to teach and read to their child from birth?
All right. What about programs that have helped African-American mothers advance reading and other forms of education?
Well, I would suggest, and I may be bragging, that giving African-American mothers, but not just African-American mothers, but white mothers and Latino mothers, Native American, Asian-American mothers, just passing a book, a copy of March, it's graphic, it is powerful, would encourage people to read. Young children all over America, elementary school, middle school, high school, college students reading this book. It tells a very dramatic story, and I think it will hold and capture that interest. When I was growing up in rural Alabama, I had a teacher who told me, read my child, read my child. We had very few books in our home because we were very poor. But I read everything, books, newspapers, letters, and I wouldn't be where I am today if I didn't have someone telling me to read.
March 7th, 1965, Bloody Sunday. You and some others led over 600 marchers across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. What do you recall about that day?
Well, Sunday, March 7th, 1965, about 600 of us attempted to walk from Selma, Alabama, to Montgomery, to the state capital, to dramatize to the nation, to the world, that people of color wanted to register to vote. We were orderly, peaceful. We got to the top of the bridge, the highest point on the bridge. Down below, we saw a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers. And we continued to walk without anyone saying a word. We get within hearing distance of the state troopers. A man speak up and said, I'm Major John Cloud of the Alabama State Troopers. This is an unlawful march. We're not be allowed to continue. I give you 3 minutes to disperse and return to your homes or to your church. One of the young men walking beside me by the name of Jose Williams from Dr. King's organization said, "Major, give us a moment to kneel and pray." And the major said, "Troopers, advance." You saw these men putting on their gas masks. They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks, tramping us with horses, releasing their tear gas. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. I thought I was going to die. I thought I saw death. Almost 50 years later, I don't recall how I made it back across that bridge, back to the church where we had left from. But that day provoked a sense of righteous indignation on the part of the American people. They didn't like what they saw. And President Johnson responded by speaking to a joint session of the Congress and introduced the Voting Rights Act. We made it from Selma to Montgomery. Rather than 600, more than 30,000 of us made it there on March the 25th, 1965. The Congress debated the act, passed it, and was signed into law on August 6, 1965.
At one point in the early 60s, you were jailed for 40 days.
I was jailed in Mississippi during the Freedom Ride in 1961. Back in 1961, blacks and whites couldn't be seated together on a Greyhound bus or a Trailway bus, leaving Washington, D.C., traveling through the southern states. We were on our way to New Orleans. We never made it there because of the burning of the one bus, the beating of us in Birmingham, and later in Montgomery, jail in the city of Jackson. We feared the city jail, the county jail in Jackson, and later we were transported to the state penitentiary at Parchment.
And 5 years ago, some 48 years after you had been bloodied by the Ku Klux Klan during a civil rights march, you received an apology on national television.
Yes, one of the men who had attacked me and my seatmate beat us, left us bloody at the Greyhound bus station in a little town called Rock Hill, South Carolina, came to my Washington office with his son. The man was in his 70s. His son was in his 40s. He said he had been a member of the Klan. He said, "I'm one of the people that beat you, Mr. Lewis. I want to apologize. Will you forgive me?" And I said, "I accept your apology. I forgive you." His son started crying. He started crying. I started crying. They hugged me. I hugged them back. And we called each other brothers.
Ben Daly and Baker, good morning. You're on with Congressman Lewis.
Yes, good morning. Congressman Lewis, I have great appreciation and admiration for all that you've done in terms of human rights and civil rights. My question is concerning Robert Kennedy. Did your opinion of him change when after you found out that he bugged Dr. King's phone at the behest of J. Edgar Hoover? And if not, why or why not did that opinion change? Thank you.
Well, I admired Robert Kennedy, and my feeling toward him didn't change. I think it was J. Edgar Hoover who insisted to the president, to President Kennedy and to the Attorney General, that kept saying that Dr. King was under the influence of the Communist Party and he needed to wiretap him. And I think that was the motivation for Robert Kennedy doing what he did. But Robert Kennedy had a tremendous amount of respect and love and affection for Dr. King, as he did for the Civil Rights Movement. I remember him saying on one occasion in 1963, he said to me, "John, I now understand. The young people have educated me."
We're short on time, but when President Obama won, you said whether or not this was the fulfillment of Dr. King's dream, your answer was no, it's just a down payment.
Well, I didn't think the election of President Barack Obama was the fulfillment of Dr. King's dream, that it didn't erase all of the problems that we still have and will continue to have in America for some time to come. But I think it went a long way to move us closer to to a truly beloved community, a community at peace with itself.
Well, Congressman Lewis, thank you for a great life and for sharing much of it with us today on the air. And we'll see you a week from tomorrow at LSU on the 21st with your author, Andrew Iden. The book is March. It's been a bestseller now for 40 weeks, and it is quite a ride about the life and times of Congressman John Lewis. Thank you both.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we shall return tomorrow. For Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.